Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Black History Always. Black History Always is a new podcast in partnership with The Undefeated that takes a deep dive into the stories of now and tomorrow from a Black aperture that will empower and inspire. Hosted by Clinton Yates, rate, review, and follow Black History Always. Also, relive one of the greatest icons and most successful teams in sports history, Michael Jordan and the 97-98 Chicago Bulls. Stream the Emmy and NAACP Image Award-winning series The Last Dance on ESPN+. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, it is that time of week where we do an interview, but it's also the first installment of The Right Time Trivia Contest. 8 contestants playing for charity. $5,000 goes to the winner's charity. But first, coming to us live, I almost feel like this is one of those, the man who does not need an introduction. You probably remember him most from his time with the Indiana Pacers, multiple-time All-Star, 6-time All-Star, multiple-time All-League player, and you can find him on Untold. Netflix has a new series called Untold that's going back and looking at some big sports stories from back in the day, and they have an episode on the Malice in the Palace, and Jermaine O'Neal is joining us for that. Jermaine, what's going on?
Pretty good, brother. Thanks for having me on.
No, no problem. I have to ask you, the immediate thought I had as I was watching this and we went back to 2004, what in the hell were we wearing?
a lot of things have changed, man. Only if we knew what we knew today back then.
Yeah. It's like one thing I look back on, because I remember when the dress code came in and I was vehemently opposed to it. And on principle, I still am vehemently opposed to it in a lot of ways. But I'm 40 years old now. And then I go back and look at some of those clips and I'm like, oh, that's what they was talking about.
Gotcha. The 8XL shirts. And
So I wanted to ask you about Untold. And again, I really recommend people check this out. And I was just telling Jermaine that I am someone who has studied this event many, many times over, but still found myself really learning some things I did not know about, you know, what happened that night from watching it. But I also watched the Quiet Storm documentary that Showtime did on Metta World Peace a few weeks ago. What was illuminating about that was hearing your side of just how you felt over the years and watching as Ron Artest, as his career had gone in the different places he's been and the way he handled his exit from Indiana, which is something that I really hadn't thought so much about. And so I was kind of curious, given, you know, there was a lot of pain I picked up from you and how all that went. I was a little surprised to see you in this documentary talking about it again. So what made you want to share your story in this setting?
Well, so obviously it is a very sensitive topic for me. I've looked to do this doc for about 10 years now. That's the reason you can never see me talking about it publicly. Yeah, I felt like, you know, it was almost celebrated when I hear people talk about it, right? It's like this conversation about a night that was really just a tough night overall for everybody that was involved, but it never really got to the real story, right? To understand that night, you have to understand everything building up to it. And when I sat down with directors, producers, nobody really understood it. I wanted to do a film, not for the avid basketball fan, right, that knows what this is, but for the person that I'm actually running into in boardrooms that don't watch basketball, but know about the brawl, right? And so when you look at this doc, you know, one of the things that was really that really bothered me was a culture was attacked by an event, right? It was, you know, braids, it was tattoos, it was thug, thug, thug by some of the most prominent people that I have a lot of respect for in the media world that was really quick to judgment, but didn't necessarily have all the information. And that part really bugged me out. And to still be talking about this thing 17 years later, people asking me all the time about the brawl, I just wanted to do something that really put all the players that was involved, all the people, when I say players, and have people, you know, really talk openly and honestly about everything, relationships, that night, pre-brawl, and even a little bit of post-brawl. And I think we're able to accomplish that.
Yeah, and I think one thing that could be easy to lose sight of as time goes is that that was the year for that team. Like, you guys were set up to make the leap that year. I think the other part that I didn't really do the math on was that was Steven Jackson had just gotten there, right? I hadn't thought about the fact that he was kind of new to the situation, and Ron had been there, you know, for longer, obviously, but I really hadn't thought about, like, the dynamic of him being the new guy and you being the next guy with Reggie Miller's career coming to an end.
We were set, too, because we had just had the best record the year before, right? And we were so talented and so young that they threw the ball, we just went and played. Didn't necessarily know how good we can be until we got to the end of the year, and then we ended up facing the Pistons in the conference finals. They ended up beating us for a couple of reasons in that series. I think the most important reason was that they knew who they were, and we didn't quite know. But we knew coming back into that year, because I had all the players come in early, make sure, like, I think it was like a month early before training camp, to make sure that we were ready to rock and roll, because we believe that we can win it. And that's the reason why, too, it's such a sore spot for me, because it's hard to win championships, right? And if you have an opportunity to win it that year, then you have to put everything into it. And if you have any distractions, any other broken relationships on teams, it just doesn't equate to winning it. And that's the thing that happened to us.
And I guess something else that I knew obviously at the time, but hadn't really thought about, that I wondered as I was watching this, is what in the world is going through Rick Carlisle's mind as all of this happens, right? Like, a notorious control freak who wants to keep everything under control. Like, hey, he's got this roster. And then all of this happens.
Well, I can tell you this. Obviously, you know, Rick, I love Rick to death. He was a phenomenal coach for us. He's been a phenomenal coach in our league for many years. I still have not asked him. I've had many conversations with Rick, and I still have not asked him, why was I the first person taken out of the game instead of Ron, right? Knowing what we knew at the time, right? You take him out of the game first, you leave, you know, myself or some older statesmen, you know, inside the game, but that never happened. But I will say this, one of the things that I walked away from this doc, because I think it's important for people to know, I executive produced this and put this, all this stuff together, but we did not, Jack or myself or Ron, didn't shoot the doc or Reggie together. We shot all separately. So when I saw the doc, it was like the first time that I was able to hear Ron talk about his struggles mentally and how, you know, adversity takes him over the board, right? That was one thing that really jumped out to me right away, because mental health is something that's not really, it's talked about across the board now. But back then we didn't know, right? We knew he had a psychiatrist that was with him all the time. But I think people were, you know, a little bit afraid to talk about mental health, because that was kind of like an ACL tear back then, right? It's like the death of a career. But I wish I was able to be as educated about mental health back then as I am today. I think I could have been a better brother, teammate, you know, to Ron, because back then I'm just responding, right? I'm like, what are you doing? Right. Because it was like, you know, retirement one day, music the next day, this day, this, that day, don't show up that day. And it was just like, it was a lot to take in. And I wish that I had an opportunity to at least from that perspective, write that part of our relationship.
Yeah, because we just thought he was crazy, right? Like, in the parlance and the way that we talk about the time, like, what I remember everyone always saying about Ron at the time is everybody loved him, and he was the nicest guy in the world and had this big old giant heart. And then he might snatch a camera from the cameraman and throw it down on the ground and then get suspended for a time. And I think you're right. We did not publicly have the tools to discuss that kind of thing at that time.
To a point, you feel like your heart reaches out to him because he still has to battle that thing. That's a real thing that you got to live with every day. And it doesn't help when, you know, when you're on the biggest, brightest stage, you know, in sports, in the NBA, and, you know, and people have a narrative because of some of the things that you do. So now they're poking at you, right? They're starting to poke at you and get that reaction. Ben Wallace said this in the doc. I can't remember if they kept it in the final version of it, but he said, we knew we can get Ron off his rockers, right? And maybe not in those necessary words, but they knew that can poke at him a little bit and get a reaction. And for me, I wish I was able to have that education to bring him in and keep him calm.
Well, another interesting thing that I always remember, because watching those clips, it's almost like it's an amazing who's who of the NBA at different points when you look at some of those shots. Like, hey, there's Rick Mahorn. Hey, there's World Wide West, right? Like, you have all these different people that come up, and one of them is Rasheed Wallace, which is not really like, hey, it's Rasheed, because he was on the Pistons at the time. But that was your former teammate with the Portland teams that had, shall we say, all that personality at the time. What was it like looking back and seeing then as Rasheed Wallace as Peacemaker?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had a lot of different teammates, and I would probably think that I'd be more equipped to deal with Ron because I had, you know, J.R. Ryder, you know, Sheedy, Antonio Wingfield, Cliff, you know, the late, great Cliff Robinson, and many more. But Sheed has always been a really good dude, right? And again, perception, right?
Right.
That's out there, right? He get technical, so he's crazy. He's, you know, he's this, he's that. But Sheed has been a family man who is about his community, you know, who loves to play basketball, but didn't necessarily like people all the time because of that, those conclusions that they've drawn up. And I wasn't surprised to see him do what he did. Now, I got to say thank you to Sheed, because Sheed took out some time to do the interview. He actually didn't make the final cut, and Larry Brown didn't make the final cut. I wish those two would have made the final cut, but we would have had to eliminate something somewhere. And they made the ultimate decision on a couple of things. But I felt like he knew where this thing was going. And at that point, we needed everybody, all hands on deck, to try to help stop what was going on in that arena that night.
And I wonder for you, in terms of going back and looking at everything and seeing other people talk about this, like as a producer, because that's a very interesting process to get in there and then try to figure out what stays, what doesn't, what's important, what's not. But that's me talking about doing that with things that don't matter to me personally, right? Like you were producing something that is, for better or worse, in a lot of ways, a defining moment of your career. Like emotionally, what was that like for you to do?
It was hard. It was hard. I mean, you know, you want to keep everything in. I think either way, something, you know, we had to get it in a certain amount of time, you know, get all the information, you know, into the doc in a certain period of time. And, you know, some would have got left out. It was very personal to me. But mine, it, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I get it. Like, I understand, like, the NBA is a very special place, right? It's a privilege and it's an honor to play in that league. And it has awarded me an opportunity to take care of myself and my family and others for many generations now. Indiana Pacers, the same way, right? I feel a certain way about them. They gave me the max deal. It was some information out there that they could have used to come to my support, right? People don't realize, Bomani, that I actually took the NBA to court and won. People think that I served the 15 or 25 games or whatever it was, but I actually went to court, went through arbitration, and then got to a federal court, and the judge said, I had the right to do what I did, right? And that was never even spoken about. It was like, okay, we just got to just get away from these guys. You know, this is too much noise. You know, the league is under attack because it's a cultural issue now all of a sudden. When at the same time in other leagues, baseball, hockey, they are beating the hell out of each other on a nightly basis, right? And that's celebrated. People rooting from the stands. I know it's a different balance between, you know, on the court and in the stands.
But hockey gets up to the stands too. Like, let's not get that part twisted.
It does, right? It does. And we actually use that in our defense, you know, when we went to court to get me reinstated. It's been a lot of that. But the thing that really bothered me across the board, right, now I have my peers and a league that's special to me and an organization that's special to me all under attack, right? We're under attack because, you know, now we're overpaid, right? We are thugs, right? We have tattoos and cornrows. The league is adopting too much hip hop. When in the world has your choice of music be a description of who you are as a person? Makes no sense to me, right? And to hear the people that actually was saying that was like, damn. And we had a muzzle put on us. And what people don't realize, this went on for almost 10 years afterwards, right? So we can't speak about it. We got to take everything that's been given to us publicly because we have not only all the criminal stuff that we have going on, we have a bunch of civil stuff, right? We had lawsuits galore that we had to deal with. And so, you know, we're left to take whatever it is that people have given us, and people are coming to a conclusion in ways that was, to a point, honestly hurtful, because you work hard, right, to put yourself in the position to be where you at, and have people, you know, take, you know, get on television or take pens or create conclusions in our communities, you know, far, that's difficult.
Well, an interesting part of this documentary, I thought that was very important, and this has been documented, I think, more clearly than people realize, which is the conscious decision of the media industry to decide who the villains in this story were going to be. Like, if you watch the broadcast on that night and the tenor that you got from the people who were calling the games and even the studio guys, everything changed overnight. There's an oral history of ESPN that was written by Jim Miller where Mark Shapiro comes out and just basically says, like, hey, we decided that we were not going to attack the customers, which then meant that the attack went to the players. And what I had not really given a lot of credence to is somebody who, like, eats, breathes, sleeps basketball, you are a very familiar person to me, but you guys were at a level of fame where largely basketball fans knew who you were, sports fans knew who you were, and this was your introduction to the general audience. And I had not really given much thought until watching it, what effect that must have had on you, that now people who did not know who you were before now know you for this.
And that's really the main part. When your character is assassinated in ways that, I mean, people can't pick, you can't pull up anything else about me, right? But that, right? And in a situation where leaders lead in every situation, right? You have to have that level of sacrifice when it comes to, you know, that level, right? When you're in a facility and people are trying to hurt you, right? Literally trying to hurt you, or throwing water bottles on, spitting on you. And then you look around and we're 10 minutes into this thing and it ain't a soul in there with a badge, right? And so now we're forced to defend ourselves. And on top of it, they're blocking the exits, right? And so, you know, we felt like, again, it's our livelihood that's at risk right now. And when you're in that environment, you're not thinking about, okay, if I do this, then, you know, what does this mean? You like, I got to get out of here. I'm going to tighten up every single thing that comes near me and others that has on a Pacer uniform. This ain't about you being a thug or you out here, you know, wearing cornrows or tattoos. You ain't say that when we putting all this money into communities. We ain't getting that level of credibility in scenarios like that. But yet a fight happens. That is our description for our career. Come on, man. That's crazy to me.
And that was a turning point in a lot of ways for the NBA in the way that they imaged themselves. And I think I look back at some points, and a lot of it I found to be wildly offensive. And other parts I looked at and kind of understood from a really cynical, they're trying to make money sort of perspective, why some of those things wound up having to change. But now, 17 years later, do you feel like you still carry it with you, the idea of the brawl?
I was just in Vegas coaching my son's eighth grade team. And I literally probably 10 people throughout that weekend came up to me and asked me about the brawl. Right. And so, again, this doc isn't about alienation of anybody or anything. It's about education of everybody and everything that knows about the brawl. And that was what was really, really important to me. Put everybody that was there that night, you know, in front of a camera. Let's tell a story. And then now people can have educated conclusions of whatever it is that they're thinking, not just the slide and punch, not putting in the camera that somebody had just tried to choke slam me from behind, right? Or everything else that was going in, you know, into that night. Now the narrative is, okay, watch the doc and it'll tell you what you need to know.
With Ron Artest and with Steven Jackson, where would you say your relationships with them stand now?
Oh man, Jack is like my brother. I mean, man, Jack, we've been friends since 16.
Yeah, because you guys are the same high school class.
Yeah, we've been friends a long time. I was just with Jack in New York. Shout out to him, Matt Barnes, All the Smoke. I was actually with Jack this weekend, too. He was here for the Big Three. Ron, our relationship has evolved. I'm going to be completely honest. I know it's funny because when I did his doc, what I said about him and how I felt about him, how proud I was of him, didn't make the doc, right? And interesting enough, it didn't make this doc either, right? And so I think it's important to talk about that I have nothing but respect for his struggle and how he handles his struggle. Because I know now I'm better educated on what he deals with on a day-to-day basis. I did not have very good feelings about him when we played together. Did not. And I'm just going to be honest with you. I think that came out in his doc. It came out a little bit in my doc as well. But we all can say maturity is the best part of who we are as people. Right. We mature and we learn, you know, and we deal with things a lot better than we would, you know, at 23, 24 years old. When it's about, to me at the time, it's just about winning and being dependable. And at the time, you know, I thought he was just choosing not to be dependable, not knowing that his struggle was anxiety and everything else that came with playing in front of, you know, 20,000 people on any given night and cameras. Right. You know, being in his face all the time. But we're cool. You know, our relationship isn't as tight as me and Jack's, but we definitely have more of a friendship now than we've ever had in our lives.
How long did it take you to get to a point where you could laugh at the idea of him looking at you guys and saying, do you think we're going to get in trouble?
Oh, you talking about that night?
I imagine that night it was not very funny, but I also imagine that your reaction to that, if I had seen it, I probably would have found it to be hilarious.
So I'm going to tell you, I was probably on like 1 million. When I reached that locker room, because I was bleeding, you know, I had lumps and from being hit from different things, I was already like on, I'm about to lose it on anything and everything. And then the police had just came in there right after me trying to take me to jail. Like, I'm the sole person they come in there asking for. I'm like, wait, whoa, I'm not going with you, brother. Like, all of you that's out here doing this stuff, you're trying to take me to jail. And then Ron says that right after. And I just dove at it. Like, it was like, bro, what are you talking about? Are we going to get in trouble? Like, this is like one of the worst things to ever happen. And it just so happened to be on national television that night, which right. was like the worst thing that could have happened. But me and Jack laugh at it now. Again, now that we know more about how he handles things, you know, it's more of a situation where we can probably smile at it now versus back then.
Yeah, like I imagine people, when you talk about people coming up to you in Vegas and stuff like that, like I know exactly where I was when my brother called me and told me it had happened and then watching it. And I literally was up till 3 o'clock in the morning calling people, talking about it. Like when my East Coast friends went to sleep, I started calling my West Coast friends. Like for me, it was that kind of night, but I'm not involved, right? Like I'm just watching the madness from the outside. And I really appreciated about this documentary was it was one of the first times that I really had thought about it from the inside out. And yep. just what it must have been like to be in it. And for someone who, for whom this is not just some measure of spectacle, like this became a significant part of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the thing, Bomani, like just like getting people to like be open and honest, right? Every time I called and talked to everybody, you know, the players and other people and even, you know, the directors, it was like, hey, we want to capture the truth, however it comes out, right? The truth is what it is. Let people speak from the heart. I don't want you to narrate, you know, what they're going to say. And being able to tell that story, I've watched this thing 10 times, literally 10 times. And I get emotional every single time because obviously Portland was a very special place to me because it gave me an opportunity, right, to play in this league. Indiana is a very, very special place because that's my footprint, right? That's where I made a footprint, you know, as a professional athlete. And I saw what it did to the city. In many cases, it made people choose, right? You know, and that shouldn't be. It shouldn't be that in sports, right? Whether it become a cultural choosing, right? On, you know, are they too hood? Let's strip down everything that doesn't reflect to being hip hop, right? An organization that was starving for a championship, right? It was just this close, you know, 2 years before the brawl, or four years before the brawl. And now we have that opportunity, right, to see all the questions and all the hoopla of what they should do with players, how players should kind of rethink, you know, how they do things. And again, you know, I would have preferred, honestly, for Ron to fight Ben and then we have a team fight, right? Because then, you know, it's only like a 3-5, right? It's only 3-5 game suspension. But it did happen, right? And then at that point, you know, what else do you do? Right. And I would ask you this. I've asked everybody I've spoken to about this. If you're put in a situation, it's compromising your livelihood and people are trying to hurt you. And again, you cannot grasp being in a NBA basketball jersey and people trying to hurt you. So what would you do?
Yeah, I'm the wrong person to ask. I've always been team players on this one. especially my man at the end, because I was just like, well, I'm from Texas, man. Trespassing is something that we frown upon. Like once it reached a certain point, this was obviously in many ways about defense. And I always felt like once you wind up on the floor, I cannot assume that your intentions are good. That just can't be it. You know, like that was always my view on it. And it felt strange because I was just getting into business when it happened. When I watched the turn happen immediately in terms of what people were saying about what happened. And I was like, there's no way everybody feels the same way about this. This isn't possible. But it was clear that people had realized what was the right and wrong answers on that one. But I never viewed that through a lens of morality of who was right and who was wrong. Like, you probably shouldn't have gone into the stands, but I ain't really about having stuff thrown at me either, you know?
Right. I can say this, though. When people watch this doc, watch it open-minded and then ask yourself, put yourself where I was or, you know, where Jack was, and even to a point where Ron was, and then come to a conclusion and ask yourself, what would you have done in a situation like that?
Yeah. I mean, like I say, I thought that the documentary did a very good job of humanizing the people who happened to be involved in it at that time. Like, I would have loved to hear from Larry Brown, because he was in that crazy fight in 62 at Cameron Indoor Stadium, where he kind of started that one. And I've always been curious what Larry Bird thought, because Larry Bird has never struck me as a guy that really had a big problem with people fighting every now and then. That was just my read.
Right. Well, I've seen a rough cut of it, and you'll see what Larry Brown said about it.
All right, I'm with that. That is Jermaine O'Neal. Check it out. Untold. It is on Netflix. By the time you hear this, it will be available for you to stream on Netflix. Definitely check it out. It's a look at the Malice in the Palace. You hear from Jermaine O'Neal. You hear from Ron Artest. You will hear from Steven Jackson, all the major players, and some fans with some very interesting things to say that I wanted to save for the people so as not to ruin the maddening surprise. Jermaine, man, thanks so much. I really appreciate you.
All right, man. Thanks for having me. This is the Right Time Charity Trivia Tournament. Two contestants get five questions. Whoever gets more right advances. They're allowed one multiple choice lifeline. Let's get to know these contestants. Up first, we got Nick Wright. Puts the one in FS1. Welcome, Nick. What charity are you playing for today?
I am playing for Big Brothers Big Sisters of Kansas City. I'm glad I'm not playing against Bomani or against Dominique. I'm glad I'm not playing against Bomani because he knows all this stuff, and against Dominique because losing to him would be the low point of my career.
It started feeling like a compliment. Like, no. I don't want to play against you guys because you know too much, but then it ended as an insult.
Nope. Yep, that was confirmed. Confirmed. Let's go.
And I said you put the one in FS1.
Correct.
How dare you? All right, moving on. I hope you lose now. You don't want to get the host on your wrong side. Now, to our returning champion, the man with the plan, my favorite contested on today's show, Shannon, too many N's in his name, Penn.
Ear.
Ear. There's a lot of N's.
Shannon, Penn.
Yeah, man.
What's up, brother? Who are you playing for today?
Yeah, I am playing for the Stuart Scott Memorial Cancer Research Fund at the V Foundation. So I'm playing to fund research into why so many cancers disproportionately affect the African-American community. So I'm playing for the V Foundation today, guys.
All right, and Gabe, get this man a point off the top.
Yes, sir.
No objection.
Just give him one.
Objection.
Just give him one because I like it.
I mean, it's good charity, but I...
And briefly, can everybody show these shirts off? Because we have Right Time Trivia shirts, and I just want to show that I actually got my friends out here wearing my face on their chest.
I noticed that.
Like, that's going a long way.
I feel like that was a little much. Yeah, I knew I was getting t-shirts. I didn't know I was going to have Bomani doing the... on the t-shirt.
It was Gabe's idea, baby. It's Brandon. It's Brandon, baby.
So
it's Brandon.
What did you think? The first time, not the t-shirts, but the first time I saw the new Right Time, image with Bomani going like this, I was like, who's that guy? Like, I've never seen Bomani do this move.
Yeah, I thought it was promo shot for the Hanging with Mr. Cooper reboot that I thought was coming.
Wow. Wow. I'm not that tall.
Everybody can get it even if your face is on the shirt. All right, Nick, you're up first. You ready?
Yeah.
So you understand, five questions coming your way. You can call in your multiple choice lifeline, and I'll give you four possibilities. If you don't need it at all, it doesn't matter. You still don't get to use it.
Okay.
All right, first question. Which NBA player is nicknamed the logo because his silhouette appears in the NBA logo? You got to let me finish the question. You got to let me finish the question.
All right, well, the answer is Jerry West. I thought I was nervous to begin with, but that now I feel great. Jerry West.
We're warm, man. We're just easing you in.
Okay.
All right. Which swimmer won 23 gold medals at the 2016 games more than any other competitor?
Is this still me?
No, I think I read that wrong. Which swimmer won 23 gold medals up until the 2016 games more than any other competitor? Yeah, it's you.
It's still me. Michael Phelps.
Well done. I'm surprised you had to think about that one. Just being safe.
Did I use too much time? Is there a penalty on it? Or
I mean, so the first time I can't finish my question, and this time you were.
Well, I was just, I wanted to take my time since the question was mangled, and I was like, no one has ever won 23 medals in one game, so I want to make sure it's not some Jedi mind trick and going, let's go.
That would have been impressive, though. You got to cross events to win 23 medals in one Olympics. All right, here we go. In the 1992 Olympics, the Lithuanian basketball team was able to afford jerseys because of sponsorship that they received from this music group.
Oh, not that easy anymore, huh?
This music group.
It was news to me too. I want to mock you, but this is a hard ass question. I'm not even sure this qualifies as sports trivia or music trivia. But either way, it's up there.
I was like, who scored the most points against Lithuania? I know a lot about the Dream Team. All right, lifeline me.
All right, here we go. Pink Floyd, Bon Jovi, Grateful Dead, Pearl Jam.
Glad I went with the lifeline because my answer was going to be U2 because it seemed like the type of thing Bono might do. So we have Pink Floyd, Bon Jovi, Pearl Jam, and Grateful Dead. We're going to remove Pink Floyd and Grateful Dead.
I like this strategy. It's almost like you have experience on game shows with lifelines.
I feel like it's something. Pearl Jam's kind of weird. They're like, hey, Ticketmaster, bleep off. I'm going to say Pearl Jam.
Bo, what do you think?
Oh, that means I got it wrong. It's Bon Jovi, isn't it? Is it Bon Jovi?
Nope.
Grateful Dead.
How do you know all this?
Why?
They wore tie-dye jerseys. Like, that was right after after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so that was a very Grateful Dead-y thing to do.
The tie-dye does convey a message, no matter whether it's on
shout
the jersey.
Shout out to Sharunas Marshall Lotus. He was on that squad.
All right. Don't stay Warriors legend. I'm 2-for-2 on sports questions. I'm 0-for-1 on stupid music.
All right, number 4. Which MLB team called Jack Murphy Stadium home until it was renamed Qualcomm Stadium in 1997?
So this is why I almost didn't do this competition. But I was really concerned there was going to be a super basic baseball question and I was going to get it wrong and be exposed.
No, I got you. So we hit you with a music question. Now we hit you with real estate questions. This ain't sports.
Okay. So the only Jack Murphy I know of is Jack Murphy Bunting. Qualcomm. God dog it. I thought that's where the White Sox played. The Chicago White Sox.
Incorrect. Oh, Shannon's shaking his head. No.
Shannon
knows.
You
know the answer, Shannon?
Yeah, San Diego.
Well done. You don't get no points for that, but
that's all right. Cool.
You just get the flex on them.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I can't get myself out there.
God.
All right, here we go. Last one. How many seasons did the Raiders play in Los Angeles before moving back to Oakland in 1995?
Stupid. I should have saved my multiple choice for this one. How many seasons before... How many seasons? Restate the question.
Okay, here we go. How many seasons did the Raiders play in Los Angeles before moving back to Oakland in 1995?
Country of origin.
Not a dead air.
Eight.
We got music. Eight? Is your answer?
No, it's not. But judging by your face, I was saying, I guess I can't change it. It's obviously wrong.
The correct answer is 13.
God damn it.
Alright, so
now Shannon walking in like his Family Feud and you look up and you only gotta get like 60 points. You know what I'm saying? Like you ain't gotta do that much.
Oh man, so what'd you get there? I got two.
In fairness, I only got 3 sports questions. But I only got 2 right.
Alright, Shannon, let's do this, man.
Alright, man.
You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Who broke Travis Kelce's single season record for receiving yards by a tight end in the same year Kelce set it? I mean, to be fair, Nick, this is a harder question. I'm just saying this is a harder
question.
You
saying it's a harder question is a hint. You just let Shannon do his thing.
Jeez. All right. Single season tight end. Gosh, I can see his face. His name is escaping me right now. Think. What's old boy's name? Receptions.
Precious, getting to
it. It is already.
But money. Would we consider this a lemon booty moment?
It's getting tight.
It does seem to be a little bit tight.
It is. Oh my god. I'm thinking old boy from San Francisco. Oh man, I'm drawing a blank on his name. All right, I got nothing.
Okay. The answer is George Kittle. It happened in 2018.
Wow. Nick did not want to give him a chance to come back around. He shut that door immediately.
And then Kelsey rebroke the record in 2020. Let's go. Back alive.
Ooh, I drew a blank. I drew a blank on his name. I knew the team. I knew the dude. Yeah. Like, I'm looking at his face.
You had it all. You had it all. And Nick was like, no, you have gotten this wrong.
I've never seen Nick that happy in my life. All right.
Okay.
What navigational device is featured in the Seattle Mariners logo?
Navigational? I mean, a compass?
Nailed it. Don't sound so
all right,
unsure.
Cool. All right, look, I'm going to make sure.
He had a little unsure of himself, right? Like you had to get your rhythm back.
Yeah, I'm good now. Okay.
Here we go. This next one for the tie. You ready?
All right, let's go.
What plastic animal did Florida Panthers fans throw onto the ice during the 1995-96 season in playoffs?
Florida Panthers. I'm going to go with a plastic animal. I will go with a rat.
Woo! Tied it up.
Yeah, right, man.
Two more to go.
That was right.
Take the lead. Clutch.
Yeah.
Clutch.
That was Vance Beesbrook. Right, Vance Beesbrook was the
Yep. That's Shannon being a Rangers fan. It just don't come up at work very much.
I mean, you could have said any name, and I would have nodded my head. Yes,
Ben George Beesbrook. Kittle and got quarter century old hockey fandom stuff.
Black people watch hockey. Hashtag Black people watch hockey.
Black person watches hockey.
No,
shout out to Roy Bellamy.
He the one. yeah, when that question came up, that's the first person I thought. Florida Panthers hockey, Roy Bellamy. All right, here we go. Who became the first player in NFL history to rush for 3 touchdowns in a single Super Bowl game?
Al Bundy. Oh, sorry.
Al Bundy had 4 touchdowns at Pope High, right?
You're right.
All right. 3 rushing touchdowns. Okay, I'm going to go with Marcus Allen.
Sorry. We got Terrell Davis. Ah. I see you guys come storming in right there, Nick, for the steal.
No, I'll be honest. I would have also said Marcus Allen. I thought the famous game with the Raiders, which evidently I didn't know what city they played in at the time, the worst. that he had 3 touchdowns. All right, so here it is, Shannon. No pressure.
Yeah.
But if you get this, no, right, I built you up. Win. If you're not, you're gonna
absolutely. I built up the suspense. That's what we do. Look, as a fan of the '90s New York Knicks, this is what we do. We blow it.
Here comes Ewing on the finger roll.
Prior to the 2016 Olympic Games, when was the last time the U.S. women's national basketball team failed to win gold at the Olympics? Shannon Penn.
Prior to 2016 women's national team. All right. You know what? You know what I haven't used? I haven't used one of my multiple choice, which I waited for my last question. Oh, no.
Me too. Me too. I was going through my head like, am I allowed to remind him or not? All right. Here we go. Montreal, 76. Athens, 04. Barcelona, 92. Beijing, 08.
And can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. Prior to the 2016 Olympic Games, mm-hmm. when was the last time the U.S. women's national basketball team failed to win gold at the Olympics?
Failed to win gold. And my options one more time.
Montreal, 1976. Athens, 2004. Barcelona, 1992. Beijing, 2008.
All right, let's see. All right, I'm going to go with fail to win gold. All right, you know what? Let's have some fun. I'm going to guess. Because I'm debating between Montreal and Barcelona. So let's see. You know what? Let's go Barcelona, 92.
For the win! Shannon Penn steals it.
Woo! Wow. I knew it couldn't be Montreal, though, if they wanted to go technicality.
How'd you know?
Because they didn't play in 80.
Yeah. I don't know these things.
the boycott was in 80. So I was like, I probably can't be 76. I didn't even remember them losing in 92. Right. Look at Shannon remembering America's lowest moments and cashing in on it. Look at Nick, salty as hell over there. He never entertained the possibility he was going to lose.
Especially because the swing question is about the 92 Olympics. Shannon, it just has to remember that when the Dream Team won, the women didn't. I, meanwhile, need to know nonsense about Eddie Vedder or whoever the hell is in Grateful Dead.
You want to know how I actually figured it out? It was actually because of the 1996 and the push that they had for the women's team in 96 on the heels of not winning in 92. So the 96 team was a big deal.
Now, you know what's happening. Nick grew out his hair and all the mystery went away. And so we tried to give him a softball Grateful Dead question because we figured that that came up at your crib. But oh, no, no, no. Nick's like, I've been with this black woman for 15 years. I don't know about no Grateful Dead.
Grateful Dead.
Well, Nick, thank you for participating. I'm sorry that I won't get to do this with you once again because you will not be invited back to the trivia show. Is there anything about the 1992 Olympics that you want to share? You want to flex some of that Dream Team knowledge?
Charles Barkley was actually the best player on that team in that run. And I can't believe a Qualcomm stadium sponsorship. Is this endorsed by Qualcomm? Hey, Qualcomm, if you still exist as a company, you should donate money to Big Brothers Big Sisters of Kansas City. I'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Oh, wow. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing three times a week. Gabe Bassett today, practically heading everything behind the scenes. Dominique Fosworth, the host. Shannon Penn, today's winner. Nick Wright, something else today. But you got a great shirt on right now. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy. Hey, Nick, look at me.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.